Christian Parenting.
Welcome to the Living Wholehearted Podcast. We are Jeff and Tara Mattson, a husband and wife team who is shrinking the integrity gap in our own lives and helping others do the same. I'm a leadership and organizational development coach, and Tara is a licensed marriage and family therapist.
We believe that if you have a following, you are a leader, and how you lead matters. Whether you are leading in the home, work, or community, we are bringing you biblical, clinical, and relational wisdom to help you in every relationship that matters most to you. None of us do this perfectly, but we are leaning into the reality of our humanity and profound wisdom of grace. Middle of a parenting series. Being a parent is one of the most important leadership roles you can have. And ironically, with all the books and the wisdom offered in the world today, there's only one you and one of your child, and no one else has ever parented that child before. So it gets confusing. There's not a manual on that child. And so we have to figure it out in real time. And yet there's a lot of principles and things that we can understand about child development, wisdom from the scriptures, and understanding from years and years of research of what human beings need to cultivate health and wholeness. This is why we want to talk a little bit about anxiety. It's one of the leading issues right now in our culture today. And I have really good news for you because I have one of my friends and really a beautiful expert in the area of child psychology, Dr. Kristen Valerius, with us today. She's been impacting teens and parents and anyone and everyone who is needing to reframe their understanding of who they are and how God meets them right where they're at. So Kristen Valerius has been a pediatric psychologist counseling children, adolescents, and families since 2006. She knows what she's doing, folks. She's been helping with a wide variety of behavioral difficulties, with strained parent-child relationships, depression, anxiety, school refusal. How many of you know what that's like? Toileting and feeding difficulties, as well as learning and attention deficit disorders. She is the executive director of Sunstrom Clinical Services outside Portland, Oregon, and she's supervising a large staff of psychologists, professional counselors, and prescribers. Hopefully today's conversation can bring some peace to your mind, your heart, and your soul, and maybe a little laughter as well. It's so good to have you with us, Kristen.
Thanks so much, Tara. What an honor. You are just doing great things, and I'm really happy to be a part of it.
Well, I love it because we get to see each other when we've got our clinical hats off and we're just being moms and a part of our church community. So we serve together in lots of different ways. We were we're able to serve by speaking to our church a couple Sundays during a series on bringing peace to mind. And Kristen gave the most beautiful sermon in helping people understand what anxiety is. I had to bring her on. I wanted you to hear the wisdom that she has been given so graciously and been working with parents and teens. We're going to hone in today a little bit around teens, Kristen, and we'll start there. But before we do, tell us a little bit about you and how you became a child psychologist. Most of the people in our field get into this field because of their own stories and wanting to kind of undo some of the things that we experience, but not everybody. Talk about your journey.
You know, my journey was more, I was one of those kind of quirky kids who just was always really fascinated by people and kind of trying to understand like how people ticked and our brains and bodies. My dad was a professor of neuropsychology. And when I was really little and would go to his office, you know, sometimes kids are like, I want to use the copier, Dad, or like you have cool things being in the business. Well, I really wanted to see his brain in the closet in a bucket of formaldehyde. He had like a real brain. And if I was good, he would take it out and let me see it. And that was so fascinating. And, you know, I think I felt such a strong conviction early on about how Christ was in the Bible and walking alongside people and trying to like help them feel understood in their stories, that deeply, you know, convicted me as a kid. So I just really enjoyed walking alongside people. I'm a kind of extroverted person that I just really love being around people. So I couldn't imagine a job where I was just sitting behind a desk or things like that, and did a lot of outreach like early on, you know, ridiculous things. In junior high, my friends would tease me that I had kind of a Lucy booth, you know, Lucy from Peanuts cartoons.
Oh, yeah.
Hopefully not as mean as she was. She was kind of mean.
But
like, I would have kids kind of want to talk about what was going on, and and I'd stand and talk from one to another. And so I don't know. I just felt like it was kind of always wired in me to really enjoy that deep connection of people's story and their experience. And then it was, you know, how am I going to live that out professionally? Am I going to go into medicine? Am I going to be a lawyer advocate? And psychology really presented the best opportunity for me to just have the time and space to like really walk alongside people. So I don't know, I kind of fell into it naturally, but it wasn't necessarily from like my own trauma or my own experience. I would say it was more from my like curiosity and understanding of like what makes people tick, including myself and my own kids and all of that. So that's been sort of a through line of my whole life, I think.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you had people who were mirroring that back to you and helping you really recognize that that was part of God's design in you. Mm-hmm. Or was this something you were such an introspective kid that you were noticing your own experience in the world? I like people. I'm inquisitive. I'm curious about relationships.
Yeah. I mean, I think I had the fantastic like mentors and people who poured into me. And I always felt like really connected to a bunch of different adults. So for sure, that's true. Our church community really kind of like wrapped me up. And I just felt like I had, you know, 10 moms and in the good sense of that. And so, yeah, I think people let me be who I was. I have ADHD, so I also was very much too big for my britches and had to kind of grow into this impulsivity and sense that like, I can do that. Like, why can't I? And, you know, had to help have people shape that into something that could be useful instead of bulldozy. And so I think I got a lot of grace to learn to love myself and love others along the way. And I don't know that I was really sheltered from hard stuff either. Like I was aware that people were going through hard stuff and I wanted to kind of lean into that more. Yeah. And so I think people gave me permission to, as a kid, like ask questions and be curious and not just have it be like, oh, you know, you're a kid. Don't worry or don't talk about that. So, you know, kids know what's going on around them and they want to know more. So that was me. And I was given a lot of support and encouragement in that. And people believed in me. And here I am. Sometimes I think, gosh, who am I to be sitting with you in your journey that's so complicated and so sacred? And so it's just really an honor to be given that privilege for so many.
Yeah. And the work that we get to do is so sacred. And we're on the front lines of really peeking behind those sacred parts of people's hearts and minds and their stories. What are you hearing, especially when you think about the teens in your office these days? What are some of the themes that you are hearing kids say today that you wish parents could hear and glean from?
That I wish parents could hear and glean from. That's a different approach to initially, on the one hand, I feel like mental health has come through, like, it's not as stigmatized anymore. Like, there's a lot of acceptance and a lot of reflection on go to therapy and have a counselor and that's a good thing and it's okay. And I have kids who are on their student councils working with their schools to make mental health sick days the same as physical health sick days, that there should be some like parity and understanding that wellness includes all of us, you know, body, soul, and spirit. And so the willingness for our teens to acknowledge what they're going through in their interior world, I think is a shift maybe from when I was growing up or even earlier in my career. And so I think kids really want some authenticity, some realness, some the desire to not have to have it all together, not be okay, not have to have the answers. They kind of want to show up with one another on the journey, figuring it out. And I think that's hard for parents because the normal process that adolescents go through of taking things, their identities on and off and trying out different identities can mean like, oh no, what if my kid lands here? Like, I'm not a big fan of this identity, or I'm concerned about this stage, and rightly so. I mean, we have kids who are struggling and suffering, and so I don't want to minimize that. But especially post-pandemic, I think I've been surprised where kids, I was like, as I watched their journey, I'm like, oh no, what's happening here? And then I'm like, oh no, you're course correcting. It's okay. We need to just like let you walk through that. And I think when kids are expressing more and willing to take some of the veil off, that might feel scarier as parents to kind of look under the hood more than maybe we've done at other seasons where kids kept that private or secret. Mm-hmm. And so then we feel a little more out of control, like, what do we do? And we have to help them and we have to fix it. I think parents feel such tremendous pressure to make their kids feel fine. And that's not really our job. I frequently find myself saying it's not our job to keep our kids from suffering. It's our job to help our kids know how to handle suffering. And I think especially moms feel like if they're suffering, I'm supposed to make it all better. So I have to be the perfect mom, or I have to fix it, or I have to give them answers, or I can't stress them out, or I have to like pave the way for them, or that teacher's really stressing them out and I have to go do something. And so I think it's hard for us to shoulder that burden as they build muscles to carry some of that stuff themselves. And I don't know, equally, I think kids, as the stigmas come off, there's also this weird rebound effect that all the kids want to have a diagnosis and a label, and they're self-diagnosing through TikTok. And so sometimes there's also this move to say, oh, I have this disability, or I'm impaired, or, you know, I have this diagnosis, so I can't do X, Y, and Z, but I don't know that I really want to fix it right now. I just want to, like, that identity gives me a sense of uniqueness or specialness. And so helping our kids, it's like a balance, because on the one hand, we can trust that it's okay for them to walk through a process and journey and not get too worried. But also we don't want them to camp there, mm-hmm. and just say that everything I am is anxious, or everything I am is depressed, or I have autism and I can't function. And I'm not trying to minimize those diagnoses, but that's been an interesting shift among adolescents as mental health is being talked about more over social media. It's how they identify. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you notice that showing up, Tara? Well,
and I think there's some beauty in being able to educate yourself. I'm sure doctors feel this way too. People come in way too late because they've already gone down their own diagnosis and tried all their treatments. So there's some beauty in that, in being able to equip. But there's often, I've seen just a lot of misdiagnosing, right? And not fully understanding that there's a set of symptoms, and all these diagnoses are looking at just a set of symptoms. And when we get under the hood, to use your words, and the roots, that might not be exactly what this is about. There's biological versus circumstantial and environmental factors that are playing a role in. You know, one example would be kid coming in saying they have ADHD. Well, then we start to evaluate their digital life and realize that it's probably digitally induced ADD. And so when we pull off of all the digital, they start to feel their bodies calm down. They can pay better attention. So it didn't
it was good for us to assess for that, but changing some of the environmental factors would not affect somebody with a biological diagnosis of ADHD.
Right.
And they would need medication. So there's just this this dynamic that I hear you saying is parents to slow down a little bit and to say this is a process, particularly for teens. They're so hungry for identity. And so sometimes they're grabbing on to a particular form of that identity. And we've got to hold the long view with them and not panic ourselves in this moment in time. Yeah. So,
and help them look at multiple aspects of that identity, right? My identity isn't all, you know, my school ability, or it's not all my diagnosis or my athletic ability. And to really build kind of that robust foundation that you can begin to understand yourself in all different corners of the world. That's hard to do as a parent because, you know, their journey is to begin to differentiate and to look at that themselves and be less interested as a teenager in our influence. And so they don't always receive it well, but they still listen to it. They still are hearing it and feeling it. And so we want to keep at it.
I think that's important to say to parents, that I often want to tell them that your kids are actually listening to you, even if they roll their eyes or slam the door or don't want to show up at dinner. However it's looking in your home, they're still paying attention to how you're turning toward them, your own attitudes toward them, the words you're saying, it sticks. So I think that's really important reminder that we have to regulate our own anxiety. We are going to talk about parent anxiety, and I do want to get there, but let's keep talking about these teens. When you have a teen showing up, and maybe they've self-diagnosed themselves with anxiety disorder, and they're coming in, and it's legit, and they're working through some real intensity of how their body's responding, what are some of the practical steps that you would take with a teenager? Maybe first define what is healthy anxiety and what is diagnosable, like our more mental health, what we would see as you need some help. Because parents will often just hand their kids off to us as professionals with any sort of anxiety. So sort that out a little bit for us, Kristen.
So, you know, anxiety is really such a beautiful function. I mean, it's so protective and it's so involved in motivation and goal-directed behavior. So we have this capacity to forecast in our mind 1,000 things that will happen. You know, kids play simulation games, speaking of their digital world, not all, but those are really popular sim games. Well, that's our brain all the time, is running 1,000 sims. So you and I kind of already imagined today how this conversation will go, and we simulated a few things. And that guess of our future outcome leads us to take certain action in the here and now. You know, we prepared and we made sure we got here on time without anxiety and that function in our brain, so we would lose access to so many of the best parts of ourselves that we become motivated to put into practice because of how we want the outcome to develop. The challenge is our brains are adapted to spend more time finding the negative outcomes. You know, I talk about anxiety is related to our danger system. It's not exactly the same. And I think historically we've kind of talked about them like they're synonymous. So that danger system that would say, oh no, there's a predator lurking. I heard a growl. And if we hear a growl, we don't want to guess. If we were out in the, you know, wild jungle, we don't want to guess that that's a cute baby lion. Because if we're wrong in that guess, and it's Mufasa, I would say, then we're really in danger. We might die from that guess. So it's way safer to guess that it's a predator, a parent lion, and to get to action plan around that. So worst case scenario is super useful from a survival standpoint. But worst case scenario is not super useful when you're sitting in your class and that kid over there gave you a weird look. So that's our brain is naturally wired to spend more time and pay more attention to the negative outcomes that may not even be very realistic. It doesn't matter if you're trying to survive, if it's realistic, it's still ideal to pay attention to it. But when you're trying to function, carrying the burden of a bunch of unrealistic, unlikely events becomes overwhelming and debilitating. So in some ways, what anxiety is about is the uncertainty of how something's going to turn out. And there's always a hopeful outcome next to it that maybe our brain hasn't camped on as much. Because if there wasn't a hopeful outcome, if there was only a negative outcome, we would probably be much more fearful than just anxious. Anxious is like that fretful, and you keep coming back, but what if it's this? But what if it's this? But what if it's this? And that means you don't know for sure that it's this. You don't know for sure. So what do you hope it will be? And if we spend more time thinking about what we hope for, then we can, it has a different impact on our body. So anxiety is so healthy for telling us what we care about, how we want something to go, what motivates us, what we're passionate about. But we have to work to use it as information and then shift it to something a little more functional and useful, or to be able to do something with it. So I think sometimes when there's access to so many people, so many outcomes, so many pressures, we can become overwhelmed by all of those possibilities, and our brains don't stop running the simulations, and we can't ground in the today, and we only live in the what will be, what could be, that might be negative. So the feeling of discomfort that is what brings most people into the office, I hate how I'm feeling, may not be the biggest challenge, because that feeling alerts you to, hey, there's something going on that you care about. You really care about getting into college. You really care about having a strong friend group. And so that feeling can be useful, and you can listen to it, and you can develop some behaviors that help you integrate that feeling as information and warning signals and motivation. Now, when it becomes problematic and it's more of a diagnosis is when it starts impairing your normal daily functioning. So if now I care about something so much that I can't do some of my daily tasks that would bring me joy or that are important, I can't go to school, or I can't calm down, or I can't do social engagement anymore. So when it starts to get in the way, even so, it's not so much about how much distress you're experiencing, how uncomfortable it is, but how much is it keeping you from doing things that build a joyful life? Not even necessarily a happy life, but a rewarding and satisfying life. That's sort of a tipping point that we need to look at. And I think a lot of the focus is on the emotional part and just making the uncomfortable emotions go away. And there's a risk to that. If we just want to feel, there's lots of things that just make emotions go away. I think the substances, there's a lot of other coping tools that are about quieting our emotions and making them go away. But learning to sit with them and listen to them and let those emotions teach us something valuable, and what does it mean? Why is it there? That can be a lot more productive.
Yeah, it goes back to what you were saying earlier in wanting parents, like our job is to help our kids learn how to suffer well, to care and to find comfort in healthy ways, not to never have difficult emotions, not to never have difficult situations, to rescue them all the time from that, because that's not life. So you're just saying part of anxiety is it's an information giver. I'm going to go on a tangent real quick and then we're going to come back.
Yeah.
But in our core values index, we use this assessment often in org teams, but we use it with marriage and with parenting. And I love to do this, particularly with teens,
and parents because it helps us know what makes us most anxious based on our God-given wiring. So a higher banker who really cares about excellence and justice, their anxiety is going to go higher when things aren't exact and facts and information aren't given. And so it cues us into who our child is and going, okay, their body starts to give them a warning sign and they need more information. Let's tell them more about where we're going for the week. Give them the itinerary, let them do the research, right? Just more information helps that anxiety calm down. For builders, their anxiety rises when their goals get impeded. And so oftentimes parents have to learn how to let builders do it themselves. They're kinesthetic learners, but they get anxious when they're impeded and they're being told they can't do something they know they can do. And a merchant is all about relationship and really gets anxious when they feel like there's not harmony in their relationship. So you hear them talking about the friend dynamics and the people pleasing, more anxiety. And then you have the higher innovators who are wisdom kids who really come up with a lot of solutions and are the wise souls that everybody comes to. But sometimes they can hold too much and they're fearful of making foolish decisions or someone else might make a foolish decision. So we can kind of help even with seeing how God designed our kids and to say anxiety helps us get to know them better and to lean in and to teach and coach them because this will be an area for them for the rest of their life.
Right.
And then those of us that have the biological bent towards anxiety, we have an extra dose that's running through our systems. But I love your reframe that it's information and you're helping us to sit with our emotions and not fear them and not react to them and not try to quiet them.
As parents, we're always looking for quality tools and resources to help our kids develop a relationship with the Lord. This is why Christian Parenting is so excited for you to get your hands on a new devotional journal made just for kids ages 6 through 12 called My Time with God. Your kids will use this colorful and fun devotional to read scripture, engage in creative activities, deepen their prayer life, and learn the benefits of spending time with God every day.
Over 20 days, your kids will gain a solid understanding of Christian principles like what is prayer, why spend time with God, who is the Holy Spirit, and more. We all want our kids to grow with a desire to spend time with God and be in His Word every day. But we also know that being consistent can be really difficult. So don't miss out on this opportunity to help growing believers learn how to connect more deeply with God. For more information and to get a copy of My Time with God, go to cpgive.org. That's cpgive.org. What would be some practical ways that parents could tune in to their kids' anxiety and maybe without coming and working with you or I, but they can be doing right here and now in their home? One thing you already said was helping reframe for a kid. This is what you care about when you're anxious. This is what you care about. So you're helping mirror that back for them is what I heard you say.
Yeah. I mean, certainly just like reflecting their emotional experience. You know, you're feeling this and that's so hard. I mean, one of the most very basic essential tools, I think, is that validation. And validation is not necessarily I fully get it, but it's about I'm helping you feel that I heard you. And as parents, we really get into a trap of, okay, now what do we do? Yeah, I got it. And so what do you do? And we say, yeah, I understand. Okay, you want the cookie, but we're going to eat dinner and da 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 da, right? So we move on to the explanation and the guidance, and we're doing that so often that we forget how much we don't just sit with, gosh, it sounds like you're feeling this. That's really hard.
You really just want that cookie.
Yeah, you're really feeling frustrated. And also, I'm very pragmatic. We are not meant to be perfect parents. And if we are, we're going to have a different effect a different negative effect. If we could somehow be really uber controlled and always make the right choice as parents, that has its own difficult impact on our kids. We can get there in a minute. But that validation of like, I hear your experience And I'm going to give it back to you in a way that you know I heard it. Because often we're like, yes, I'm tracking. I get it. I heard it. But we didn't give it to our kid in a way that they feel like we got it. And that's what where parents get tripped up. I did a class, a workshop with parents on teens and social, well, tech in general, not just social media. And we were working on validation skills because it's really hard to talk through the complexities and the conflicts around tech when you're not relationally connecting. And so we practiced it. We talked about it. We role played. I sent them home. They were going to try to work on these skills, come back and talk about them. And so we did the first two steps are like, it sounds like, and reflecting back. And we wait until we get to, okay, can I tell you my information or how I'm feeling, or can we problem solve? My information and my feels and problem solving was step 3 and 4. And they came back and they each talked about them, and they were cracking up by the end because every single one of them had skipped step 1 and 2 and gone to immediately 3 and 4. And they started to, and as each of them shared their story, they started to be like, oh, wait, I didn't do this and this didn't, right? I didn't pause and say, it sounds like you feel this, you know, and really connect with those. So I think that's super important because I don't think we get to tools and do and try and here's how you walk through anxiety if kids don't feel heard, right? And there's a natural calming effect in our neurology when we feel heard, when our community, our herd, H-E-R-D, right? Our group is getting what we're going through, is understanding the threat that we have, that like, that calms our system, you know? So when that is the first thing in dealing with an anxious kid is to just have some space to like, gosh, it sounds like this is what you're feeling. Am I getting it right? And allowing our kid to say, no, it's because da da da, or I don't know, or whatever. And so we get some feedback, and that's the first step. As our kids feel heard and validated, and they feel like we understand their experience, and we're checking, did I get it right? Yeah. Then we can maybe get to, well, here's how I'm feeling. If we need to deal with some conflict or some challenges that are creating because of your anxiety, you're coming to me at 11 o'clock at night needing help and I'm spent, and right, that conversation goes better if they're heard. If we jump to that, it often becomes a power struggle, or you don't understand me, or all of that kind of stuff. And that you don't understand versus you don't agree, that comes out all the time in my office. My parents don't understand me. I think they understand you, but maybe you have a different opinion or different needs. So that can be worked out if you spend time with that. So what I'm hearing you say is, it sounds like you're feeling, what I see you doing, it looks to me like, yes. Then we can get to working out our conflict in the anxiety, or, hey, have you tried? You know, like, so tell me what you, here's how you're feeling. What is it that you care about most? Because when we anchor ourselves in our values and what we care about, well, I care about connecting to people, or I care about college and good grades, or I care, right? When we anchor to our values, that gives us a little wider perspective than that simulation our brain is running, that fearful experience. So anchoring to what do you value? And what do you hope will happen? Describe it to me. Break it down. Help your brain shift from all those simulations of what could go wrong to spending effortful time, intentional time. Well, what do you want to happen? Let's envision that. Let's dream about that. Let's think about that. And it's tricky work because some kids will be like, yeah, but blah, blah, blah. Yep, I get it. That makes total sense. And let's go back to finish up. What do you hope will happen? And what would that look like? And what would that feel like? Those are two helpful steps.
Very good. Do you want to go to the rest, or do you want to switch maybe to why those parents have to jump to 3rd and 4th? Like, it's in us
naturally. There's a lot of reasons why that is. But it takes effort for us parents to calm our own anxiety and our own wanting to solve the problem faster than what a teen is needing. Talk about that and maybe some tools for a parent. How do I regulate that myself?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I genuinely believe that is a really, really hard challenge. I often say I feel like God brought me to this career so I could have a lot of frequent training in parenting. As someone with ADHD, my emotions run quick and hot, and I would be tempted, I am tempted to be impulsive with my words or my reactivity with my kids. And so your question is about how do parents take care of their own emotional space? But I will start with, we have to be okay with our mess ups. Because again, as a parent myself, I'll sit in our own space of that, those first two steps. Here's what I'm seeing. It sounds like it's this. Here's what I heard you say. Did I get that right? Right? Those first two steps. So let's do that with us moms before we get right away to solving it. And here's what you do, mom. You need to do X, Y, and Z. So the first step is like, sometimes we're just going to mess it up. Sometimes we're just going to feel overwhelmed. Sometimes we're going to be sick of it. And we say, I don't even like these teenagers. They're just not very rewarding to parent, right? We went on vacation, and when they were little, they would have loved this place, but they didn't even have any fun. They were bored the whole time, and I'm so frustrated, and I have no patience left for that, right? We have all kinds of reasons why we have those feelings. And the reason I feel like our mess ups are so important to allow, embrace, unearth is because, and when I say mess ups, I don't mean the kind of mess ups you'd say if you go to a job interview and they say, tell me some of your strengths and weaknesses. And you say, oh, I'm overly conscientious and I take on too, you know, something that sells well is really a strength. I mean the kind that sometimes gives you a little, makes you a little sick to your stomach that happened. You feel really not good about. I don't mean toxic or abusive, right? There's a difference in the range, but those things you're like, darn it, I really shouldn't have done that. I really didn't handle that right. I feel some guilt, not necessarily shame, like I'm a terrible, horrible person, but we can go there if we're not careful. And the reason that's important is because then as we make that right with our kid, they get to have that experience in the world. That's how belonging is birthed, right? By saying, you know my mess ups and you still love and care about me, and we can make that right because we belong to each other. And so when I own that with my kid, they get permission to own their mess ups. So if I could somehow be really controlled and not impulsive and not say some of the things that I say, I would create a situation that my kid can't sustain that. And so then they begin to feel more insecure about how do they belong to people when they know their own kind of humanity and confusing parts. So modeling those mess ups with some recognition and acceptance and the effort to make it right is a big piece of maybe we don't get it right in the moment, Tara. You know, maybe we had a hard time acting and responding the way. Maybe we jumped to 3 and 4 and it blew up and our kids stormed off. And then we can reflect later like, oh, that was me. I didn't give you space for that. Or I was having a different feeling myself that was working against listening to yours. But that, I think, comes from a recognition that we don't always have to do it right. There's so much pressure as moms, I think, to like get it right and be all for everyone. And then we don't get enough time and space to just have our feels and express them and mess up and fix it. So I think that's a big piece, accepting our own imperfection, having people that we can talk to about that. But then I think creating space and time for self-care, for checking in. Probably most of the advice that we would want to give to our kids in that step 3 and 4, here's what I'm thinking and what I need, here's what you could do. I bet a lot of that, if we turn it on ourselves, has a really useful impact on us too. You know, if we're coaching our kid through their social anxiety and we think about how we feel when we're going into a group that we don't know very many people, you know, I think what we want to give our kids, if we take a hot minute and give that back to ourselves, it's so useful. A lot of times we know some of the tools, but we're so busy giving it out to other people that I don't know that we always take time for ourselves to use those same things. We can be more concrete about that, but I think some of the concrete suggestions of relaxation, and self-care, and finding enjoyable activities and exercise and sleep and nutrition and drinking water, and those are all fantastic. And they also can, I don't know, I find those can be tricky for moms sometimes.
Yeah, just time. We're short for time. But that's the only reason I exercise is, well, I shouldn't say only, but I exercise honestly so that it gets out some of my intensity and my reactions to the rest of the day. And I'm a much better mom and I'm more responsive. So my family all knows. In fact, my girls will be like, Mom, did you exercise today? Because my intensity goes way up. And so it's a natural release, but finding what works for you and the why behind it, I think you're inviting us in, is so that you can show up and be more present. And then when you aren't and you mess up, the owning and the repair work is part of the modeling and the beautiful intimacy, attachment work, and the belonging.
Safety, yeah. And
helping our kids see what grace feels and looks like and is experiencing it, not just talking about it. And we have to do it over and over and over. Unfortunately, we don't, none of us arrive. So I love that's where you start. And I think the voice of I've got to get it right, every time causes way too much anxiety. So let's just drop that one.
And some of the reason why that's where I start, Tara, is I know a lot of tools from my training. That doesn't mean I'm always able to pull them off, right? And so that grace and acceptance and realizing the power of belonging and making things right, that is so powerful. And if you have that confidence, we can make this right, that's such a buffer to anxiety. Because anxiety is, what if it doesn't go right? We've had lots of experiences where we can fix this. It's okay. Mess ups are all right. You don't have to do it perfect. It's just one time. That's really helpful to ground ourselves in.
It's so good. So, you know, in my work with women particularly, but and with men, I've had many of them do timelines and try to look back and see the themes in their stories and maybe some of the bends of ungrieved places and trauma. But it's interesting to me, you know, as I've sat with 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds, if there has been some sort of repair, even so a terribly unhealthy, toxic parent who's come back around even years, decades later to do repair, there's significant
such power
that happens. So when we're doing that in the smaller ones, you know, when we have a bad day or we're not as patient or we say something that's off the tongue, and we repair it in real time, I go, man, that's good news, mom and dad. It's really good news. But even if we have decades of a lot of heart and need to do repair, it's never too late.
Right.
Every child, no matter how old they are, long to hear that recognition from a parent. And it goes deep. The Lord made us in such a way that there's just deep healing that happens when we repair with one another.
Yeah.
Okay. We're winding down, Miss Kristen. What is the last thing that if you had to tell everybody, this is the truth, the wisdom, you've given us gold, really gold nuggets here. But what do you want to leave parents with today as we close up? Especially around teens.
I think that, I mean, probably my gold for that cuts across all diagnoses are some of those truths around accepting imperfection and seeing that as part of belonging, and about not feeling like you have to eliminate your kids' negative emotions and experiences. Those are so essential. But, you know, parenting teens can be so hard. It can really not feel rewarding as a stage. And so working hard to find and cherish the moments that are, and to use some of those, like, who is my kid? You know, your CVI index helps you conceptualize and break things down into ways that our brain can hold on to. But if you haven't gone through the CVI or some other tools like that, just jotting down what are the strengths and passions and things so that you can find moments of joy and connection, because they're not always easy. Our kids don't always give us those moments as often as teenagers. And I think we grieve that connection. I hear that so often in my office. And I think the kids grieve it too, but they need to do this. They need to do this stage. And so they're not going to say that as often, but they tell me about it. They tell me that they're sad that they're not feeling as close, but then they're not going to give you a chance. So cherish the moments of good connection. Cherish the moments of where you see your kids' light turn on and their joyful hope. Enter into things that are their interests and passions, even if it's not yours. Sometimes I have moms playing video games that they're terrible at with their son because that's the best way to like enter his world. But also do that within the context of making space for yourself. Because if you're just pouring out to everyone else, there's not a lot to give, to draw on. And then we're more likely to need our kids to make us feel good and whole and restored. And I sit with parents who it's really hard to find the space and the time for themselves and their own needs. So that's a hard-fought journey for a lot of parents. And so keep up that good fight for yourself and hold on to the moments of joy and connection. And if you're feeling like it's a hard slog, it is, but it's not forever. And you can push through. Things are going to change. Trust their journey and process too. No, those are some of the truths I wish I could hold with people. And often I get the luxury of saying, gosh, if we knew then where you are now, in a good way, most often, if that younger self could say, wait, here's where your kid's going to wind up. Here's how it's going to go as a mom. There is a story, an arc to your story that you can trust and rest in.
And that's good. Yeah. And remembering that grace sees the long view. God sees that with us. You know, man, if everything was judged based on the moment in time, you know, but to see the arc of our stories and to believe that our children are on a journey and that there's not this arrival place. Give ourselves that permission to be human, models that for them, prepares them for the good and the hard of life and not to have to white knuckle their way through life. So such good wisdom today. Thank you for your time, Kristen. And if somebody wanted to connect with you or learn about more of your guys' services, where can they find you? And we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, sunstromclinic.com is our website, and it has all the phone numbers and, you know, ways to connect with us. We have a staff of about 18, so I'm not the only person here to connect with. We have, like, wonderful providers, many who are deeply faith-filled, so there's lots of choices of people that you can walk in your journey with, so that's the best way.
Love it. Well, we're so grateful that you are being intentional to grow and learn. Share this with someone. Leave a review. Their parents need encouragement right now. We're just so discouraged and have way too many expectations on ourselves right now. And so share this with someone who needs to hear some encouragement, grace. Maybe they've got tweens and they need to be reminded about what this teen journey is about. Maybe they're struggling with anxiety and just to hear some practical tools
We're grateful for just joining us each week, and we've got some incredible interviews coming this next couple weeks, so stay with us. And if you want to leave a review, we read those, and it helps others find the Living Wholehearted podcast. Until next week, continue to be the leader that you would follow.
This podcast is powered by Living Wholehearted, Courageous Girls, and the Christian Parenting Podcast Network. Thank you for joining us in this critical movement of shrinking our integrity gaps between what we preach and live.